It's up front and it's candid. This is Unrestricted. This week, I had a chance to sit down with Laura Shera. She's the daughter of Ron Shera from Minnesota Bound and everything that is the outdoors here in Minnesota. And she has really taken off in her father's footsteps as far as covering the outdoors, her love of the outdoors. But I think you'll enjoy just sort of her story, her background, where she came from, the inspiration from her dad, from her mom as well, from her sister, her love of fashion, her love of cooking, how she's blended everything into this world that she's created where she's breaking down barriers and really having us reevaluate what we think of women in the outdoors, you know, women in fashion. She's truly a trailblazer. I think you're going to love her inspirational talks and the things that she does believe in and what has really forged her success to this point. So here's my talk and here's my sit down. This is Laura Shera, Unrestricted. This is brought to you by Douglas and Todd Small Batch Bourbon. It's Minnesota made and nationally recognized gold medal bourbon. Douglas and Todd has aged over 5 years. That's right, 5 years in white American oak barrels. And it's subject to the drastic temperatures of the Minnesota North Country. And all that cold and heat, well, it allows the barrels to breathe much more frequently, which gives it that smooth, award-winning taste. They also believe in a regenerative system of distillation. What the hell does that mean? Well, all the wheat and the corn is grown just 30 miles from the distillery. Then the fermentation waste is used back at the farm for cattle feed. That's what that means. It's eco-minded and taste-approved. It's Douglas and Todd Bourbon. Please enjoy responsibly. 21-plus bourbon whiskey, 46.5% alcohol by volume, produced and bottled by Ed Phillips & Sons Company, Princeton, Minnesota. Well, how about this? We added yet another supporter to our team. This episode is also brought to you by my good friend Pat Kelly at Wexford Harbor Insurance. I don't know. Maybe I was like a lot of you guys. I thought all insurance was the same. Just give me the cheapest price and let's move on. Well, I was so wrong. You know, Pat and his staff helped educate me on what was the appropriate coverage and what is the best value, not just the cheapest price. He can do all of that because he's an independent agent. He's not owned or limited by big box companies. Nope. He represents over 40 different insurance carriers. And those 40 different insurance carriers, they work for him and they work for you. Go to wexford-harbor.com/unrestricted for a quote. And keep in mind, it's the old school fancy spelling of Harbor, H-A-R-B-O-U-R. Or hit him up at their email at info@wexford-harbor.com. I just want to thank you, first of all, for joining me, because this was originally scheduled for 2 days ago.
Yes, it was.
And then you had something come up, which I do want to hear about. And then I had something come up in the last 24 hours that I just flew back from this morning. And so thankfully, we were able to accommodate each other. And here we are.
Totally. Well, thank you for inviting me. I was so excited. I didn't know you started a podcast. So when you sent me the note, I was like, absolutely, I'll come hang out with you in the studio and chit chat. And I'm sorry I had to ditch you. I ditched you for a little bit of fishing on Lake of the Woods. It was a last-minute offer. I had to take it. I'm like, sorry, Ben, I'm going to have to push you to 24 hours later to make this happen.
Ditching is a strong word, because an opportunity like that to go up north to go fishing in the capacity that you did, that's not ditching. You just got to, like, take that opportunity.
It was a wonderful opportunity. I had not fished Lake of the Woods before, and it's almost embarrassing to admit that, just because it is so iconic for its walleye fishing. And when the opportunity came up to zip up there really quick to do some fishing, I really wanted to take it, just because I've heard such amazing things about the lake. Like, basically every time you drop your line in the water, you have a fish on the end of your line. And unfortunately, that was not the case for me. When I was there, the winds came up the night before, and actually that morning, and like 25 mile an hour wind gusts. And on Lake of the Woods,
that's a lot, yeah.
It's like the size of the ocean. Have you been on that lake before?
I've never been on the lake.
It feels so wild when you're up there. It feels like you're in Alaska in a weird sort of way, because the lake is so enormous that because you couldn't go on the lake the day they had the 25 mile an hour wind gust. I mean, you would have been in swells so big your boat would have been in trouble.
No kidding.
Yes. So we stayed on the Rainy River, which was still windy but bearable. And the next day the wind had laid down, as they call it. It calmed down. So we decided to go out to the spot near the shore. We didn't even go way, way further in. And the swells, just from the day before from the wind, were huge. It felt like ocean water.
So and is this a boat just, that you rented?
No. This is my friend Cheyenne. It was her dad's boat. Okay. And they have had a cabin on that lake for, I don't know, 15, 16 years. So they're very well versed in the lake and how to manage it and when you go on the lake and when you don't and all the good spots. But anyway, so it was fun to experience the lake and see, how big it is. You know, it has over 14,600 to be exact, islands on it. And part of it is in Canada. And Canada owns part of it, half of it, and Minnesota, or the United States, owns half of it. A lot of the islands are on the Canadian side, and we weren't, obviously, with COVID, allowed to cross into Canada. But obviously, when you're in a lake or river, you don't even know where the border is.
Well, so, yeah, how do they patrol that?
They must patrol it just with whatever their DNR is. I don't know if it's – I don't know.
But you could find yourself on the Canadian side just
– We did. And actually, we did for a second because Cheyenne's dad's GPS was down for a minute. We were having problems with electronics, and – we floated like maybe a foot into Canada for a second. And he's like, turned it back on. He's like, whoops, we're in Canada.
So there's not like an electric beeper or something.
No,
and nobody comes flying
no
up
fence,
with their.
Yeah. No. But anyway, it's just a really cool lake. And yeah, it has 65,000 miles of shoreline.
That's amazing.
Including the islands.
And so, I'm amazed that you haven't, in all of your travels, through everything that you've done with all of your ventures, that you haven't been up there yet.
I know. And my dad was so excited for me to go because he said the same thing. He's like, you really need to experience Lake of the Woods. And he's been up there numerous times. It just hasn't worked out. And, you know, we have 15,000 lakes here in the state. So it's hard to
it's hard to pinpoint.
Capture all
of
them.
Exactly.
And I'm truly, my passion is musky fishing and bass fishing. Walleye fishing is probably lower on the list for me. It's so anti-Minnesotan to say that. I get it.
It is.
I love to eat them. But walleye fishing really consists of a lot of jigging or even sometimes you're trolling. And as a kid, my dad put out hula hoops in our backyard. My sister and I would practice our casting skills. So he'd put this plastic plug, not a hook, on the end of your line, and you'd have to cast in the hula hoops. And we played these games all the time. And so as I've gotten older, my fishing, part of the fun for me is seeing how accurate I can be with the casting. So with bass fishing, sometimes if you're top water, a lot of these bass are hanging out right underneath the dock or right by a tree and a log. And that is part of the fun for me is casting into those really small spots and not getting snagged and just watching the explosion of bass. So that's more my passion than just jigging. So that's probably why I hadn't made Lake of the Woods such a priority. And then musky fishing is just really top of the list, but...
And, see,
and you
I've
can
never,
get muskies on that lake, but
and
not.
I've never done the muskie. I've accidentally caught a muskie.
Awesome.
And it was scary.
Was it? What happened?
Yes, because, look, I grew up partially fishing. I wasn't like – it was just catfishing, and you just throw a worm in and a bobber, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Right? And then we moved here, and I went fishing, and I accidentally caught one. And sort of like when I lived in Kansas and I caught my first alligator gar – I really thought it was like a prehistoric fish that nobody had ever seen. And I'm like, what did I just catch? Because I'm not touching that thing because there's teeth and it looks nasty and it looks mean and it's going to bite my fingers off. And so I was scared. And I'm still a little scared to like take all fish off the hook.
Sure.
I'm not the most confident, although I do like it. But musky, no. Walleye, I feel you totally on just the – to me it's – kind of boring.
Yes, they can be.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If you're not catching things, especially.
Yes. I like the activity of bass fishing.
Yes.
And although I'm not very good at it, I do like the idea that depending on the situation, it could be just a different spinner. Okay, let's take that one off. Maybe that's a different color. Let me do that. Let me change my strategy. So there's always like a thinking involved, and you're always sort of casting and reeling, and you're playing with your a little bit of a different speed and a twitch to it.
Totally.
So I do dig that probably more than anything else.
Yeah, bass fishing's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And musky fishing, I mean, they are prehistoric monsters when you get one on the other line. I equate it to, you know, it takes so many casts to really even get a muskie on the end of your line. And you have to put so much time in. But it's almost like the idea of the slot machine. If you put one more nickel in it, it's like the next cast. And you might have this, you know, epic trophy fish on the end of the line. And if you're a true muskie fisherman, the joy of catching the fish is also the adrenaline of getting it back in the water as fast as you can. Because you do not keep this fish out of the water long at all. So part of it is net it, get it out of the water, quick take your picture, measure it as fast as you can, and get it back in the water as fast as you can. There's no like take your time, get your camera out, because you when you know muskies are really purists, they want to preserve this fish immensely.
Oh.
And they're sensitive fish because usually when they get to, you know, past 45 inches and bigger, they're old. So you have to handle them with a lot of care, and that's just part of the rush. So you are, you know, just moving so fast in the boat, and then you're like, hurry, take the picture, and then you just gently put it back in the water.
Are they sort of violent when you get them out of the net? Do they thrash around a lot?
You know, they do a little bit, but they oddly don't. You know, like a bass or walleye especially, they put
yes.
their little fin up and you're going to poke your finger. The thing with muskies, you know, when you hold them, traditionally you should never hold them by their gill vertically. That's kind of an unspoken rule because that can cause some damage. You want to hold one of the gills but then hold the belly.
Right.
And yeah, I've had some like flap and you get slime all over you, including your face or whatever else. You just don't care. But they do have sharp, and I don't think they're teeth necessarily, but they have really sharp something in their gills that cut up your fingers like sandpaper sharp when you're holding them. So I usually have like bloody knuckles after you're done taking your picture of a muskie all the time. But it's like, you know, it's bragging rights, I guess.
Yeah, it's a badge of honor.
Yeah, the badge of honor when your fingers are bloody and whatever from your muskie.
See, I'm too scared.
I would feel that
gill plate and I'd feel the roughness.
Your adrenaline would be going so much, you would not feel it.
Oh, it's the same thing with catfish. If I catch a big catfish, and because of the little pokers on the outside and the top, I just don't know how to like grab the thing.
Yeah.
And so I, poor fish. I mean, I'm never like very gentle with those big ones when I catch because I'm too scared, man.
Yeah. Well, the noodling thing. Have you?
No. I will. No.
I have no desire.
You
to
could
that
put
either.
That on the list of things that I will never try. And if that was like one of those, hey, for $1 million, would you do this? I don't know if I'd still even do it for $1 million.
I know, because you know where you have to go in like muddy, mucky water where it's like
turtles.
Snake world, right? There's like water snakes and things in that water. No, thank you.
Yeah. So to rewind a little bit, just so we make sure that everybody that's listening understands that obviously when you say your dad, we're talking about Ron Shera. The iconic Minnesota outdoorsman turned TV host and huge enterprise here in the region. And I think it's fascinating that even from a young age, you mentioned you and your sister just out there casting. Like, did it ever seem like you weren't interested in it? Or is it just like, this is the way of life. This is what we do. So ergo, we're going to go out in the backyard and cast into hula hoops.
You know, I think my dad did a couple things really well with raising daughters to keep their interest in the outdoors. And there's some things maybe he'd probably would have done differently. And I actually just interviewed my dad for the Minnesota Bound podcast not too long ago. And we were talking about kids in the outdoors and how to keep them interested and why it's so important for kids to be introduced to the outdoors. But, you know, growing up with my dad, my sister and I obviously were following him along in the pheasant field when we were really little. And he did a great job teaching us about the circle of life and harvesting your own food and the importance of being able to do that in conservation on top of it, of keeping wildlife habitat and waterfall areas and wetlands, that we keep them in good shape because it's really part of the ecosystem and things like that. And he made it fun, you know, with the hula hoop games. Mm-hmm. And he always said as kids, though, he's like, you let me know when you've had enough. So he wasn't pressuring us to stay out or saying
never
you're doing
you.
It wrong,
right.
And things like that. If you know, he kind of did it in shorter doses, but there were times where, you know, we were laughing about my sister's first boundary waters trip. He booked an entire week up there, which is, you know, very rugged. And my sister got eaten alive by deer flies on the back of her neck, and she had like a ponytail in, and my dad didn't realize it. And she kept kind of complaining, but he thought she was just complaining.
Yeah, just being dramatic. Yeah.
And her whole neck was raw, like raw meat, because she had been eaten alive by bugs. My dad's like, whoops, probably missed the bug spray there, you know, things like that. My sister today, she's like, I'm never going back there again.
And how old was she?
She was, I think, like 10 or 11. And then that was, and I had to do the same trip. And after hearing her come back home, I'm like, I don't want to go. And he's like, you're going. This is like a rite of passage. And so I got to bring a friend, but he did make it shorter. So, but it rained the whole time. So my experience was it was downpouring rain the entire time we were there and you're portaging your canoe. And but it was still a good time. You know, our guide kept calling it liquid sunshine and trying to make it
sure,
a good time.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
But so there are some experiences where you get pushed too. And I think it's good to get pushed for your limits with being young and being in the outdoors, because it teaches you a lot of things, from patience, humility, respect of other wildlife, respect of the earth and the planet, and things like that. So it's such good lessons. But there were a time where my sister and I, you know, we both got into horses and then boys in high school, and we kind of faded away a little bit from the outdoor thing. But then as we got older, we both circled back, just because, you know, that's what my dad does. So spending time with him, and it's fun and it's always an adventure. And so that's kind of how we stuck to it. But it really is just making sure that it's fun. And if it's, you're not catching fish with little kids, don't keep them out there.
Yeah.
Pack a lunch, pack snacks, pack a game. So it's not just you're fishing and that's it, kind of.
Yeah.
Thing.
And there's definitely been times, even this summer, I've taken my kids out and even our neighbor kids out. You know, obviously just through the COVID summer, you're just trying to find things to do. And I always love just going down and taking my kids fishing. And it's the same sort of thing, just bobber fishing. And we're just kind of catching whatever will bite the line. But, you know, there are times where my wife would be like, "You're already back?"
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, "Abby, we weren't catching anything." And, you know, I'd rather not be, A, fixing lines the whole time.
That's true.
You know, because that gets frustrating.
Yep.
But two, you know, once they feel like they've had enough, it's not the place, especially if mosquitoes are out and there's bugs and there's whatever. And, you know, just get them out there, let them have fun. Once they're done, just take them home.
That's
and
right.
And sometimes it might be 30, 45 minutes.
That's true. Yes. Very true.
But it's great.
Yes.
Like I love it because it's so easy. You know, if guys want to go and take their kids and do other activities, you might spend the whole day or half the day doing that one activity. But, you know, going out and enjoying the outdoors, or at least fishing for me, has been a huge thing for my kids. And hopefully they keep it up.
Absolutely. Have they been? Do they like going?
They do like going. I mean, they actually, of all the things that we do, it's the one thing they sort of ask me to take them to go do. You know, rarely
awesome.
Do they say, "Hey, let's go out and shoot baskets."
Yeah.
You know, they'll say, "Hey, can we go fishing?" Yeah, we can do that. We can do that.
That's awesome. And, you know, a lot of parents, too, that don't know how to get started or where to go, and I get asked that question a lot, because it can seem almost overwhelming, like, I don't have a boat. How do I introduce my kid to fishing? The Minnesota DNR recently has done a really good job trying to make it very approachable, and they recently updated their website, and to make it really easy to find a fishing guide, which I highly recommend doing if you want to have a really good time, because they know it's like their own backyard, right? They know where the fish are. Or they also did a really good job mapping out all the public piers that you can just dock fish. And there, I looked up the public pier fishing map, and the whole state is covered with dots because there's that many.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
It's really easy to find a public pier to go fishing.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of fun. So if parents are out there looking for places to try it, their website, Minnesota DNR website's a good spot.
You brought this idea that your dad was always involved with, understand that nature is sort of circular and that conservation is a big thing. Where are we with that, with this state? You know, are we good at that? Does it need like major improvements? Like, where are we in the scope of maybe the nation as far as taking care of the place that we live in?
You know, Minnesota does a very good job with the resources that they have. Obviously, they're always looking for more funding to be able to do more, because the projects really are never ending, with things that need to be improved upon, including just clean water in the state of Minnesota. A lot of people don't understand that there are water systems in our state, I believe, particularly in the southern part of Minnesota, that need a lot of help. That is, you know, one way that people can help is just buying a fishing license or a hunting license. And 100% of that goes back to, you know, conservation efforts, really. So Minnesota does do a really great job. Our entire, you know, for sure, our planet is in need of a lot of conservation efforts. There's no doubt about it, from protecting prairie landscapes to wetlands, again, to clean water systems, and even to, you know, things like encouraging farmers to plant grass ditches to help with the runoff of crops and chemicals and things like that, so it doesn't go into water systems. So there is a lot of work to be done. But we, you know, a lot of people may not know that just by buying the hunting and fishing license, and that if you are participating in the outdoors by doing that, you really are one of the greatest conservationists of our time just by buying the hunting and fishing license. It's done immense help for this state in particular.
You know, I feel like that message doesn't get out enough, because I do think that there is a large segment of the population that thinks hunting, fishing, bad for animals.
Mm-hmm.
What about the animal rights and all of those things? But at the same time, they don't realize that these conservation efforts are not just labels that they put on an organization. They really are out there trying to preserve the very resource that they're hunting and fishing.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are no one is more passionate about it to keeping those lands and the wildlife habitat and the wildlife in population numbers really healthy and balanced. No one's more passionate about it than the people that are participating in harvesting their own food and hunting and fishing and doing those things. And that, that is a really important message to get out there, that it's not really, it's not about the sport per se. That's not why people are out there participating in it. Really, it's about wildlife management, and it's really about filling your freezer with food to provide your family. And, you know, the whole farm-to-table movement has really grown, and currently it's really nice to see the field-to-plate movement growing as well, because that is really what it's about. It's not about the sport of, you know, killing an animal per se at
right.
all.
Right.
It really is about providing food for your family, and you're also making a lot of conservation efforts on top of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that food is free-range food. That food does not have antibiotics in it. It's organic. It's been free-range its whole life. It's had a wonderful life. And actually, you know, in nature, by harvesting your food, a lot of times, you know, nature in general is not a kind place. You know,
it's a nasty
yeah,
place.
The yes. deer is not just calmly passing away. Typically, it might get caught up in a disease and have a horrible death, or starvation because of winter, or a wolf is going to take it down, and mm-hmm. it's not pleasant. And if there's a way that if it's going to be harvested and it's quick, and a lot of hunters, they pass up a lot of young bucks and things like that because they want to see them grow. And sometimes that's misunderstood. So you are looking for the older yeah. males to take out for food, and that is almost a kinder way to, you know, if you're going to, a life eventually is going to end,
right.
that might be a nicer way to do it than having a wolf take you down.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is part of the circle of life, and a lot of people kind of have a disassociation of where their food comes from. You know, we see it wrapped up in saran wrap and clean and in the grocery store, and you kind of mindlessly pick it up and you have a great meal, but you don't realize that something passed away to feed your soul. And that is how this planet works. And when you can have a greater connection to the food that you harvest, you value the animal more, and it's more meaningful when you eat it.
Yeah. I everything that you said is 100% what I believe in as well. My father-in-law at one point in time was the president of the Wild Turkey Federation of Kansas.
Awesome.
Okay? So
I love turkey hunting.
Pretty nice title there. But, you know, through him, because my dad wasn't really a big hunter, you know, I really did learn that, you know, their turkey federation, much like all the Pheasants Forever and all the other conservation groups, you know, I saw him literally busting his ass to raise money and to put that back into the habitats to help find make a better, I guess, future for the turkeys that are in the state. I mean, it's kind of a weird thing to do, but they really did do that. And mm-hmm. I saw him do that, and I thought that was super fascinating. I'm like, oh, yeah, you guys actually do, like, kind of care about the birds and not just want to shoot them and eat
Absolutely.
Them and put them in your freezer. They really do care about the young, the young ones, the jakes, and making sure that there's the right crop and the right food source and all this other stuff. They really do care. They're not just out there killing. And
Mm-mm.
he hates when you say that. Like, we're going hunting.
Mm-hmm.
We're not killing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't want there to be this negative connotation behind, you know, taking an animal down. Because he really does, like you were saying, he eats these animals. If he doesn't, he'll give them away to people that will.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, hunters, too, are very much passionate about making sure that their skill level is good enough to make sure that it is when you harvest an animal, that it's done humanely and that you're not polished enough where you might injure an animal per se. And that is taken very seriously in the outdoors. And even so, you know, my dad talks about when you're introducing young kids to deer hunting per se, is to make sure they've had enough practice with archery or with the rifle, that they're very accurate and that they're comfortable with harvesting an animal, so you don't have that situation. And the hunters don't want that situation at all. And so that's also a really big part of it, is that you honor the animal enough to make sure that you have worked on your skill, that you are confident when you go out there that it's going to be something that is most humane way possible of harvesting your food.
Yeah. You know, I want to pivot real quick in the fact that you're so interesting, not for all the different hats that you wear, but maybe to tie it all in, it's the fact that you wear cute hats and the fact that you do care about fashion. And you went to college and have a fashion degree.
I do, yes.
And you have this upbringing where you are casting plugs into hula hoops, and then you go off to college and you become a fashionista and you go and work these big, incredible, fun jobs in the fashion world. And then you're blending the two together. How did it all sort of blend together from the time that you left college into your first place at work with Macy's into what you're doing now?
You know, my mom has always been a fashionista, and my mom growing up was a singer and an actress, and she wasn't as much into the outdoor thing, and she loved fashion. And I would borrow things out of her closet and things like that, and I just got this knack when I was younger, and I was actually really particular about what I wore all the time for some reason, and my mom struggled with finding me things because I was so picky about what I'd put on. But I just have always loved fashion, and I went to University of Wisconsin-Madison and got a fashion degree, and I immediately went to work for Target Corporation, and Marshall Fields was under that umbrella. And I started.
So not Macy's. Did I
say? Well, Macy's bought Marshall Fields.
Okay, there
so,
we go.
So, yes. Yeah, so I was working for Macy's after they got bought out. And so I was producing big runway shows on a national scale. So I traveled the country doing runway shows I did that for 12 years. And on the side, I was dabbling in this outdoor TV with my dad. And, you know, I was doing some fashion television as well. And
well,
I really liked TV.
How did you do that on the side? Where did you find time to do that on the side?
All I did was work. I'm not joking. From my 20s all the way through, you know, my middle 30s, that's all I did was work. I was working on weekends a lot. Just, I don't know why. I just had this drive. I just had a drive because I loved the television world. And I think I always knew I wanted to do it full time. But I loved the fashion stuff too. And I was doing fashion TV. And then I went to my dad and said, I'd love to do a couple segments on Minnesota Bound. And he's like, well, we'll let you do that on a volunteer basis.
Sure.
So I was volunteering.
Yeah, you gotta earn it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For a while. We'll see how well you do. And the more I kept doing volunteer work on Minnesota Bound, I had some other companies, you know, Women in the Outdoors has exploded. And they wanted to see if I wanted to do some work for them. And I kept having these offers, but I had this full-time job in fashion, which I loved. And eventually I left corporate America and I left my fashion career and I switched right over to outdoor TV full time. But I still produce a big fashion show for the Mall of America. And it's this year it didn't happen because of COVID, but they're hoping next year it'll come back. So I still have my foot in the fashion world and I love it. Like I love the polar opposite worlds that they are. I find them both just, you know, they're so different that I think one is the yin and the yang to the other. You know, one's really high-paced, you know, big city, probably has a little more drama in it.
Yeah.
Which I'm not a drama person. I don't like that. But the outdoors is so calming. It's so connected. It's so, you know, earthy, and it really grounds you. That, you know, when I was doing all these big fashion shows and traveling, New York Fashion Week and LA one next, and, you know, after a while, you're like, I need to be grounded. And so I'd go out into the outdoors, and that just, like, chilled me out. And so I love both sides.
Did the fashion world really sort of live up to maybe some of the stereotypes where it's just, like, once you're in it, sometimes you just need a break of and actually get into real life? Does it seem like a little bit of a fantasy land when you're in it?
You know, when you go to New York Fashion Week, yes, it does. it's very over the top. But at the same time, it's so ultra creative. And I love seeing what people, you know, not only put on the runway as far as a creative aspect, but also what they wear themselves. And some of it's so unique and it can be so over the top, but it's accepted. And I love that. Like, it doesn't matter. You don't have to fall in line to dress a certain way. And I love that. So, you know, I just like the visual aspect of it. And there was, yeah, there are elements sometimes in the fashion world that are, I would, you know, you call it dramatic because someone might be super particular about something so minimal on a piece of clothing, you know, if you're doing a runway show and, oh, this earring needs to be paired with this. And I'm like, is this really an argument? We're talking about an earring here.
Right.
So things
like
that.
But they have a look in their mind and they're like, yeah, okay, this is what the sketch is. This is what I want. This is my vision.
Yes.
And I want it head to toe, my vision.
Yes, exactly. And so you get that. And, you know, a lot of designers too are, they're artists and it's their passion and they put their whole energy and their life into their collection. And they're so connected to it that you want to make sure you're able to get their vision out in the runway. And what's challenging with that is when you're producing a runway show, there's only so much time they have in the back to change. And when things get really, really layered with like multiple rings and earrings and all that stuff, you run into problems that they're not going to make their change and then the whole show falls apart. So runway shows are like Jenga. One little Jenga piece slips and the whole thing's going to just like collapse. So that's the adrenaline behind it. That's why I love doing runway production.
And plus you've got the music. You got the club music and the house music.
Oh, yeah. It's like a rock and roll concert with fashion. It's super fun. Yeah, it's good. But I love both worlds. I don't – you know, I feel very comfortable in both sides. I love to get my hands dirty and, you know, have slimy fish hands or whatever from holding fish. And at the same time, I love getting dressed up and, you know, really keeping up on what's happening in the fashion world. So
how was it dealing with the models themselves?
You know, I hired all the models for our runway shows and they're on, I'm going to say 98% of them are fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Usually you can tell when you're interviewing and casting for runway shows on someone's energy level and kindness. And that was really important for us when we were doing big shows because we traveled to four cities together. So it was one big traveling family. You want everybody to
get along.
Yeah, get along and really just respect how big the production is because there was so much to get done in such a short amount of time that we just didn't have time for drama. And I don't like drama at all. So I just have no tolerance for that. It's just not necessary. So it was a team effort and that they needed to be on board with that. And so, you know, and I still am friends with a lot of the models I had worked with. And some of them will fly in to do the show for the Mall of America because we just enjoy seeing each other. And, you know, they're girls
so
that
fun.
Do work in New York and L.A. and they're coming to Minnesota just to hang out with – it's like family. So it really has become – it is like a family. And occasionally, I will admit, there were a few in there that we actually had to send home just because of drama and, you know, some alcohol and drug use, unfortunately. So there are occasional, you know, times where you'll have some of that. But in general, everybody's great.
You know, the reason I ask is because, you know, in the world that we are kind of both in and me leaving the football world, I do think it's – I mean, it's fair, but it's also unfair that there are typecasts and there's stereotypes.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, you know, the reason I ask is like you do see what these runway shows look like with the models. You hear about what these models are like. And you're like, oh, my gosh, are they just like total divas the whole time and whatever? And you know, I think instinctively that's not the case for most of them. But it's just kind of like what is portrayed out there.
Of course.
So, but you were in it. You were in the lion's den. So that's why I wanted to know, like, is that real?
Yeah.
You know, like,
you know, reality TV loves to create all that drama and, you know, with some of they want that on television, which is I find so interesting with reality TV and how they really kind of dial in on something that probably doesn't happen that often. But yeah, it does – would seem that way in the fashion world. But in general, from my experience, no, lovely, lovely people. And, you know, everybody's like, well, do they eat? And I'm like, yes. Like they are crushing food as a matter of fact. They just genetically have these proportions and the height. And it really is a genetic thing that and it's a very small percentage of the population that is, you know, 5'10", 5'11".
Right, yeah.
For runway models. And, you know, even a lot of that's changing now, too, with, in you know, having a lot more different body types on the runway has been, I think, a really good thing because it is such a small percentage of the population that's, you know, 5'10", 5'11", size 2'4". And, of course, you know, when you have that body shape, clothes – just drape on you, perfectly. But it is really good to see a lot more diversity happening as far as body shapes go. And there's always been a lot of diversity with, you know, different ethnicities and runway. But as far as the different body shapes now that are coming down the runway as fashion models, I think is really good.
Yeah. Well, it certainly doesn't represent what I think most of at least American women look like.
Yeah. You know, like most of, yeah, the world. Yeah.
That might look great because of your stature and it drapes really well, but that's not going to look good on me.
Yes. You know, exactly. And I think it depends on, you know, a lot of the runway shows are really curated art and it's more of like a walking art piece and something you're never going to wear it. It's not really meant to be worn on the street per se, or they call it ready to wear.
Yeah.
So some of that does require, you know, height because it's such a long trail on a skirt that, you know, if you were 5'4", you know, my height, 5'6", whatever, I mean, you'd be tripping. So,
right.
So it all depends on, you know, I think the type of show that it is, but in general, yes, I think it's good to see real bodies out there representing what the clothes will look like on real bodies. And I actually had an opportunity to do makeovers across America with Clinton Kelly. He was on the TV show What Not to Wear, the Learning Channel, TLC. And he and I traveled to, I mean, we did over 600 makeovers for a year and a half straight. This is with Macy's. And we traveled to small towns all across America doing makeovers on real women. And it was really fun and challenging at times, but it was fun to see the transformation happened with these women that, you know, in general don't know how to dress for their body types and to really get them into something that they felt great and how their energy changed. And you saw a lot of tears in the dressing room. It was really empowering just to see, you know, it felt good to see them feel good for, you know, the day.
Isn't that fascinating just about us as human beings that getting a haircut?
Mm-hmm.
You know, finding a pair of jeans that just fit you just right.
Yes.
You know, it seems like such a materialistic thing to sort of hang your feelings on and your self-esteem on. But yet that's who we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's real. You know, you find something that makes you feel good and it could be a hat or, you know, in my case with a bald head, I don't have to worry about going to the salon and like, you know, getting all dolled up. But I do, you know, I cut my hair once a week and it's funny how I can go from sort of longish hair for me and then I completely shave it down and I feel refreshed.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, and then you got to see that going around the country for these women that maybe had no idea or maybe had this idea that can't be me. That gal that's in that catalog that's wearing that really cute skirt, well, that skirt won't look good on me. But then you find something that does look good on them, and that's all you've really changed. Maybe did up their hair and did a little bit different makeup or whatever.
Yeah.
But they're like, whoa.
Exactly.
That's me?
Exactly. And yeah, it was fascinating. And, you know, a lot of these women, some have been through recovering from breast cancer to, I remember a young woman had never put on a dress before. She'd never had been able to try on a dress or whatever. And it was, she was felt so good for the day. And, you know, I hope that is, you know, encouraging enough to give them enough empowerment to feel like it's to go out there and try things and have fun with your fashion. And, you know, your body is your canvas to express it however you'd like with what you wear. And
do you miss it? Do you miss like that whole crazy vibe of fashion week and dealing with all that stuff and maybe the high intense drama if there is or isn't there, but like just that energy, do you miss that?
Well, the fashion show I do for the Mall of America is a huge one. It's over 2,000 people that attend this thing. So it actually takes me a full year of planning for a 1-hour show.
Wow.
A full year. So I.
So you get your fix.
Yes.
Yes.
And
so the flying around from city to city and bouncing from all these different fashion shows and doing all these different meetings for these other things, like
it was a grind. I'll be honest.
It's a grind, but you're fine with it. You're like that's
you
we
know
can put
I'm
that
okay.
In the past.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I love the fact that I do the one show for the Mall of America, and it's a big one, and it still is a full year of planning, and it's really fun to see it all come together. That is a good, you know, fulfillment for me to stay on that creative side.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the outdoor TV and doing all that filming too, I actually don't think I would have the time or the energy to start traveling over the country again to do all the makeovers. But yeah, it was a grind. When I was working with Clinton Kelly doing the traveling, that took a lot out of me, to be honest, just because, you know, you're gone 5 days out of every single week for a year and a half.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where did that determination and grind come from? Did it just sort of happen when you got your first job, and then it just sort of organically was like, oh, this feels good. This is fun. Let's just keep this going. And then it never really stopped. Or was that something that you really wanted to pursue, or maybe you always had as a kid, of just like, I'm a grinder. Like, I just want to work.
Yeah, you know, my dad was like that, really hard worker, and was traveling a lot because of work. And so I think probably that's where it really stemmed from, watching him do it. But when I started doing the traveling, I've never been a huge partier.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't like I felt like I was missing out because I was missing out on going to, you know, the bar for the weekend when I was younger. I just never felt like that I was missing out on that. And I really loved what I did. So I just kept going to see how far I could take it. I always just wanted to see how far I could take it. I think it was just the curiosity. Like, I knew if I was working hard. And same thing when I decided to leave my fashion career and go into TV full time. I just wanted to see, can I do this? And I didn't know if I was going to be able to do it. My dad was like, you better have a place to land before you jump. And I kind of didn't.
Didn't, yeah.
I had half of rock, not the full rock, to step on. And it worked out. But sometimes you have to take that risk and you have to follow your gut. And that's what I did. And I think that's really, really important. When you get that instinct dialed in, it never fails you.
Yeah.
And I just had this desire just to see how far I could take things. Just, I don't know why.
Yeah.
But well, I just did.
I think that's such an important lesson. And I think sometimes that sort of message can be cliched, but then when you hear it wrapped up in the context of a story like you're telling, it's way more impactful. And I think people do realize that, you know, it's okay to maybe have some doubt. It's okay to take a risk. You know, do you always have to have a plan B and C? Well, it may work out for other people to have plan B's and C's, but I'm going to put all my effort in a plan A.
Yeah.
And then if it doesn't work out, maybe I tangent and pivot to something else.
Absolutely. And, you know, failures, you know, I always say it's the breakfast of champions. Like, you are going to fail at some point in life. And it's not a disaster if you do. If anything, it's a gift. And it teaches you that if that wasn't your direction, that wasn't your door, there is another door. And it's not that you quit and give up. It's that you just go left and try a different avenue and keep going. And like, I just, I think failure is your best gift. It's never about, oh, I failed and I can't do this. It's like, whoops, that was a mistake. Let me try this.
Yeah. Do you have one in your mind right now that was your biggest failure? Or maybe how about your biggest learning lesson from maybe a failure?
Yes, exactly. We've all had a lot of failures. You know, I think I've had a lot of no's, you know, as far as television projects of
like
things that don't,
show.
Yeah, that don't come to fruition. Or, you know, at one point I wanted to go to LA and work for E! Entertainment Network. Mm-hmm. And I was close and they said they wanted to work with me, but I'd have to move there. And I had to live in LA, and then that meant I would have to do something like maybe wait tables or something, and work with E! Entertainment on the side and see where that could go. And so that was somewhat of a no, because I just didn't feel comfortable doing that. But there are a lot of those things where I wanted to possibly push the fashion career or the fashion TV thing at a younger age a little bit harder, and I got a lot of knows, and I filmed some reality TV stuff with the Style Network, and that just didn't end up going anywhere. And those things can bum you out if you hang on to it. But that wasn't my path. And I always believe, like, sounds really weird, but you'll always be taken care of if you just follow your instinct and let the universe guide you a little bit. That might be a little, like, you know, out there. But that wasn't my door. The fashion television thing was not my avenue. And looking back, I now know, of course, that I probably wouldn't have been happy living in LA, just because that's not really my style. I love to visit LA.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to work in just the Los Angeles industry per se. But the outdoor TV world that's what was my path. And I didn't really know that at the time. And I was being told a lot of no's, and that was frustrating. But again, you don't take it as personal.
Correct.
Yeah. You just take it as,
well, and
I
maybe,
go
maybe
right.
You also don't take it as personal, but also that closed door doesn't mean the end either.
No, never.
You know, just because you do fall down and it seems like I fell down or that door got closed in my face, But that doesn't mean that that's the end of it altogether. And I think that you have to have – you still have to have the right mindset going in. So going back to what you said, it's – yes, it may seem like a failure. Yes, you may have been told no. But if you approach the next thing with the same sort of positivity and the same sort of outlook, well, then maybe that's the door that opens.
Absolutely. And a lot of times you may have talked to a person and a year goes by – and, you know, nothing happens and you think, oh, that's not going to work out. Here we go again. But that's actually not the case. A lot of times it just takes time for things to develop the way they're supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And to not be so hard on yourself or to quit. And, you know, speaking from, you know, as someone who runs your own business, you can't get too down on yourself when you're networking and doing these things and you think, oh, these things aren't panning out. Well, you don't know. A lot of my stuff has come back a year later, 2 years later. Like, remember we had that conversation, you know, a year and a half ago, sorry, and all this happened, but we're ready now.
And you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
I put that thing to bed. I
exactly.
That was over.
And I never put things to bed. I just kind of let them float to where they're supposed to float. Like, you do your networking and you are, as long as you're an honest person, I think too is really important, and you're authentic.
Mm-hmm.
That is huge when it comes to the business world, that you are authentically honest in your work ethic and your intentions are honest and authentic. I think it takes you really far in that direction. And specifically in the TV world, too, you really need to be authentic with who you are on television. And I think that translates into life, too, in business connections, is authenticity and honesty are a really big deal, because those are people – the energy will gravitate back towards you because you are that person. And if you're trying to fake it or sell somebody on an idea when you know it's not really an honest something, that – people can smell that out, and the energy mm-hmm. can too, and it just was not going to work out. So I've always just kept letting, you know, networking and meeting people, and when things come together, they do, and I know it'll be the right time.
You know, I think it's funny how words like authenticity, honesty, those are all things that we just know that as human beings. Like mm-hmm. we all want that out of everybody. We want that out of friends and business partners. But even in my experience with football, it's amazing how coaches can be so inauthentic.
Mm.
And you can tell that, man, you are really trying to be this other guy, or you're really trying to be like this other coach.
I bet.
And you can smell it instantly. Within the first two meetings, you're like, oh,
yep.
That's not who you are.
Totally.
But yet, I don't know if there's this, you know, maybe they just get caught up in the whole process, and maybe they don't get time to self-evaluate and, you know, really
maybe
self-reflect.
Maybe they lack a little self-belief.
Maybe mm-hmm. they're trying to compensate for it. But it is I've found that now that I'm sort of quote-unquote in the business world, that's the same thing, that you just want people that are real. And even if the real person says, I don't like your idea,
mm-hmm.
or I don't like you,
mm-hmm.
or we are not going to work out together, that's better than stringing me along for six months to a year and
absolutely.
Making me feel like things are going to work out. And you put on this fake smile and be like, yeah, we love you. That's it. And then you walk away and you're like, never working with that guy.
Yep.
Just tell me.
Honesty is a gift, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. It's the greatest gift you can give anybody.
Well, you don't have to be a prick about it.
No.
I mean,
totally.
Like, you know, you don't have to be an asshole about it, but just say like, hey, it's just not going to work out. Okay, good.
Yes.
Thanks.
Not everybody's going to be your person, or that deal is not going to be for you, and you can't have that expectation. Totally agree with you.
Yeah.
And that's interesting when you say that you can smell it when people aren't really authentic or genuine in their intentions or their communication with you. And what that does immediately is breaks your trust. And when that trust is broken, say goodnight. Like, how you can't have a business relationship or, of course, even a personal relationship with people you don't trust. So that's why I find it's so important to be authentic in who you are all the time and be honest and even have the courage. Sometimes it takes courage to be honest. Sometimes it takes courage to tell someone, I don't think this is going to work out for us, business-wise, relationship-wise, whatever it is. That is a moment of courage, because a lot of people tend to not tell the truth because they're trying to protect that person's feelings per se, which is the wrong thing to do, and it never is going to work out in your, you know, it's just not the right thing to do. Honesty is a gift.
Yeah. But you know what the crazy thing is? You know what gets in the way of that? And this can be in sports and in life, but winning. You know, if you're working with a group of people, or you're working with somebody that you think is inauthentic and is a fraud, but guess what? If you're winning, It's so easy to cast. Isn't that easy to cast aside, though?
Like, yes.
In a sports world, it's one thing if – because we, you know, we chart everything in wins and losses. And it's fine because it's out there. It's up front. It's clean. You know, like, how are we doing as a team? Well, we won this game. Okay, we're doing well. Now, there's obviously some smaller things that go into it, and you can have some ugly losses. But even in life, if you're working in corporate America and you get this big-time sale, you may hate your partner that you're working with. But you're going to tolerate it.
That's so
true. You're
going to
tolerate it because guess what? You just won.
That is true.
I think that is the fine line.
It's a slippery slope right there.
It is.
Yep.
It is.
Because in the end, yeah.
I mean, in a utopian world, it'd be great to say, I only want to be around people that are truly authentic.
Yes.
And are truly honest. But at the end of the day, it's... can we win together and still tolerate each other?
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Now, when it comes to personal life, obviously you want your partner to be, you know, someone that is truly authentic and you can 100%. Win with on an everyday basis. But when it comes to work, it does that blending of the two does
That's
have to
true.
Take place.
That is true.
Which sucks.
It does. Yes, I know it does. You know, I try to, on a personal level, I try to work with people that have the authenticity and the honesty as much as, you know, as much as you can. I have come in contact with people who are not that. It is a navigation that's a little tricky to navigate at times, but
yeah,
no, I get it.
So tell me, what are you doing right now? I mean, what's you have a cooking show, you host a whole bunch of different shows. You've got your fashion thing going on as well. It's really kind of hard to keep up with you, to be honest with you. You know, when I'm, you know, I'm just kind of, you know, doing a little bit of prep. I'm like, my gosh, what don't you do? And how do you have time to do all of this stuff? So what are you currently working on right now?
Oh, my goodness. Well, Minnesota Bound is still filming. And Minnesota Bound, which is on Care 11, going on 27 years of outdoor television. We obviously took a break during the springtime with COVID and all of that. We were not filming, but because we do everything outside and a lot of it we can easily social distance, that we did start filming again this summer. So that show needs content 52 weeks out of the year. We have a couple reruns in there, but that is a 52-week-a-year show. So the amount of content we have to capture to fill the space is tremendous. So I've been filming all summer long, and we film a year out. A lot of people don't know that. So the stories I filmed this summer will air next summer. And the stories I filmed for instance, the stories I filmed last fall are now airing this fall. Because we want to show everything in current time when people can go do the activity, per se.
Yes.
So if I'm filming something at the end of fall, by the time you edit it, because we send all of the shows to Care 11 way in advance, so it kind of has to be done that way. Anyway, so we're filming Minnesota Bound. I do wild game cooking on the television show, work with a lot of local chefs, which is fun. It's like a cooking lesson every time you're in the kitchen with them, which is a blessing because I love to cook personally. So it's been a really fun time to learn so much about cooking. And I write for Artful Living magazine. That's a quarterly magazine that is local to Minnesota. That's been great. They've approached me because they want to embrace the part of Minnesota that is mm-hmm. outdoors. And it's a luxury high-end magazine, so you wouldn't necessarily think an outdoor article would, you know, get the attention of a luxury magazine. But so that's fun that they asked me to participate in that, so that's been a good time. And then the fashion show was passed. We didn't, obviously with COVID, are not going to do it this year, but we are doing a little virtual Zoom event on October 13th coming up with some of the designers. The designers we fly in for the show are all from Project Runway on the Bravo television show. So
wow,
they're
incredible.
Really fun to work with. So we have a couple of the designers and myself doing a panel on the future of fashion. And what does that look like? What do runway shows look like in the future? You know, how is fashion changing with everybody working from home? Obviously, it's like business on top and sweatpants on the bottom probably most of the time. And those sweatpants are a slippery slope,
yeah,
people. Careful.
Maybe not even sweatpants.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really what I've been working on.
So where can we find the information on the runway show, the virtual one?
That is with the Mall of America. So on Instagram, on their Facebook page, if mm-hmm. you go to mallofamerica.com or on Twitter, all the information is on there. And also with Artful Living magazine, we're all posted as well. And you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, just at Laura Shera.
Yeah, love
that.
I got to make sure that we get all the necessary plugs in there, and I got to make sure that we're taking care of,
well, thank
taking
you.
Care of the guests. Because you are doing a lot of amazing things. And do you feel this I wouldn't say pressure, but do you feel now that you've kind of carved out this niche in the outdoors and being a woman, like, is there a sense of responsibility that you have, you know, sort of showing the outdoors in a different light, knowing that you are a woman in the outdoors and it's predominantly a male-driven
deal? And, you know, you'd be surprised at how many females are jumping in it at a hardcore level right now, and I love to see it. The amount of women also getting involved in just shooting sports, if it's from sporting clays to tactical shooting to wanting to learn how to hunt as well, that is literally exploding. And I think it's great. A lot of women want to learn from other women versus learning from your husband or et cetera. I think that's very common.
Well, you guys never want to listen to us.
No. Why would we want to listen to you? Because it's like you're doing it wrong. And they're like, we actually need to show me how. And a lot of guys, when it comes to shooting sports, for instance, they're like, here, use my shotgun to shoot at sporting clays. Well, that's like asking your wife to use your golf clubs, men's golf clubs versus women's golf clubs. Shotguns are the same, and a lot of people don't understand that. So then they get frustrated. They're not shooting anything accurate because of the way it fits is really what it comes down to. So it's been I don't feel like a sense of responsibility. I do find that I have a passion for sharing the conservation story and also the important life lessons you can learn just from spending time outside. And I always say nature is our greatest teacher. And it will always teach you very important lessons from patience. You know, you're not going to have fish biting at the end of your line all the time.
No.
You're not. How are you going to deal with that? That's like real life. Things don't happen on your timeline. You know, we live in this microwave society where we want everything so fast. That's not how nature works. You can't decide when the turkey's going to come out of the trees. So, you know, you can't decide when the turkey's going to come in if you're calling to it. Humility, the amount of times I miss pheasants in the field, I don't even care. It's laughable. Yeah, exactly. And I'm laughing. My dad sometimes is like, how does this happen? You know, and I'm always missing. But I don't care. I'm still having fun, you know. And that's not, you know, it's not about being perfect. And so, again, like the outdoors, there's just so many things it can teach you just from stepping outside. And not to mention, you know, the grounding effect that it has and really respecting nature and how everything has a role on this planet from dragonflies on up. And it's really fascinating to me. And I do feel like there's that message that more people need to spend time outside when we have so many people in front of technology that I do find a passion about sharing that message.
You seem very spiritual. Are you a spiritual person in that sense?
I am, yeah.
I mean, you've talked a lot about the energy and just how things work together.
Totally. I know. I am very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love and I think nature is all based on energy. I mean, it really is. Like, you know, even working with dogs, they read your energy. They don't listen to your English that you're speaking to them. They don't speak English. It's really energy based. So when you start learning about the value of energy and the energy, you know, people read your energy when you walk in the room and how it's so important to have it really grounded and confident and kind.
Yeah. So you wouldn't have liked L.A.
No. Trust me, I spent enough time there. This is not for me.
About 2 months into LA, you'd have been like, enough with this crap. I'm out of here.
Totally.
Or you would about every weekend have to go out to find the wilderness
somewhere. Joshua Tree, that's close to LA, isn't it?
Yeah. That's probably what, hour and a half, 2 hour drive?
Yeah.
I think getting out in the outdoors is something I don't probably do as much. And we do look at, you know, this COVID situation as, you know, there are some positives. There are some silver linings. And I think for us, you know, I mentioned the fact that we went out and fishing more often. But, you know, even just hiking, you know, my kids are 12, 9, and 6. And, you know, we went out to now you mentioned Joshua Tree, went out to Palm Springs last year during Thanksgiving. And that was the first time we actually went on, like, real hikes. Like,
fun.
Real, like, crawling over boulders, doing all this stuff. And they could not get enough.
I bet.
And we had to pull them off the hill because we had to look at the watch and say, like, all right, it's going to be nightfall here pretty soon. And we don't have flashlights. We're not really prepared for a long hike. So we got to turn around right now. So it was that sort of fun that we had. And then through the summer, I think the kids have just really taken to the idea, kind of like you're saying with hunting and fishing, just enjoying the journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why we've just enjoyed going for hikes because we're just out there. And,
so
you know,
special.
There's no goal.
No.
You know, we're not out there to shoot something or catch something. we're just out walking a trail and they love it. And I love that for them because I want them to experience that.
Absolutely. And you're so present.
Yes.
No one's looking at their phones. No one's looking at a watch. You're just really present. And there's such a gift in just being present and having, you know, almost going into no cell phone coverage is even more of a gift when you just have no choice but to forget about
right.
it. That's, yeah.
It's a little unnerving, though.
It's unnerving. I would say your first 12 hours. And then after that, you don't care. I was in Wyoming this summer on a girls' trip, and we were in the Shoshone National Forest up into the middle of nowhere. No running water, no showers.
Your pictures on Instagram are beautiful from that trip.
I mean,
you have a very nice looking Instagram profile anyway, because all of your pictures look very high resolution and very crisp and clean. But that particular trip that you went on, my wife and I were like, where is she at? This place looks amazing. And of course, my wife loves horses like you do. And so
yeah,
she's like,
oh my gosh,
what is Laura doing?
It's such a cool place. And it's actually an elk hunting outfitter. It's a husband and wife that own it. And they just started doing summer trips of fly fishing and horseback riding because they own 25, 30 horses that they bring up into the mountains. And you are sitting, I think, at 7,500 foot elevation. And, you know, there's grizzly bears around, but grizzly bears are even higher up.
Whoa,
they eat moths during the
wild.
Summer, so they don't really worry about grizzlies coming down. But in the fall, they say, you got to be careful. But in the summer, you're like, don't worry about it. And we actually saw a grizzly through the scope. It was huge, but it was eating
a person.
Like worms underneath a rock. Yeah, it was not eating a person, thank God.
It was a femur.
Yeah, exactly. You know? I've been like, but yeah, that was an incredible, incredible trip. You have zero cell phone service and there is no way. And after a while, you have no idea what's happening in the world. Nothing. And in the way, it's like, I kind of liked it. You have the stars. You have the people you're hanging out with around the campfire.
I don't think I've ever done a digital vacation. I don't think.
You should try this.
I've done it for like 12 hours. A buddy of mine, he and I went 2 years ago to Glacier National Park. And when you're actually in Glacier, there's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like we climbed this high peak and we finally got cell service because we were 10,000 or 9,000 feet up and we got cell service. But I was so damn tired I didn't care because I was getting like full body cramps because I was not prepared.
Dehydrated?
Yeah, not prepared
oh, no.
to hike 14 miles in that day.
Did you go up with like 2 ounces of water? You're like, I'm fine.
We ran out
oh,
on
no.
the way up.
Oh, no. That's a rookie move. Man.
It's a rookie move. We ran out on the way down. There was a melting ice pack. So it was like super clean water. And we literally put our mouths in the water.
Perfect.
And drank and then filled up our Camelbacks and then proceed to go back down. But that was, you know, every day we were in the park for, you know, 8 to 10 hours and we didn't have cell service. That was weird. I can't imagine. And I suppose there's that period where like, okay, we don't have it.
No.
So now we're just going to like enjoy ourselves and enjoy the stars.
I think it takes about 12 hours, maybe 24. Yeah. And then when you're on day 2, 3, 4, whatever, you just don't care. You have no idea. Like no one can. I mean, there was a satellite phone if there was an emergency.
Right.
No one needed to use it. But yeah, I think it's really cool when you go off cell phone range. And I have a fun story for you with the drinking water straight from the stream.
I'd love to hear.
Because if you were doing the same thing, it might have happened to you. When they were that's how we had to get our water too, is right from the stream. But they had set up this like hose system where it would come through a hose. And they had a cloth there where you held the cloth over the hose and to put it in your water bottle. And I was asking what that was for. And they're like, oh, it's just for like the sediment and some dirt or whatever. And I was like, okay. And someone accidentally dropped the cloth in the dirt. So next time I went to fill my water bottle, I was like, oh, I'll just fill it right to the water bottle.
Yeah.
And I'd been doing that for maybe a day and a half, 2 days. And the owner of the outfitter, Josh, was next to me the next time I went to fill it up. And he's like, oh, you want to use the cloth? I was like, oh, I thought because it was dirty. I was like, I don't care if I drink some dirt. And he's like, no, actually, there's really these tiny, almost invisible leeches that come into the water. And I'm like, awesome, because I've probably been drinking leeches now for like the past 2 days.
Did it do anything to you?
No.
Oh, okay.
But
God.
You probably drink leeches too, is what I'm telling you.
Oh, well, that's fine. As long
they're like
as
little
didn't...
baby ones. Oh, I was dying laughing. And then he like tried to find one. And he did find one because they had some like sodas and beer sitting in the cold water too, because it's just ice cold out of the stream up there. And he pulled one up. He's like, yeah, see, there's one right there. And I'm like, oh, my goodness.
Well, you got some protein.
Yeah. I mean, that's how you survive. It was
as
like
long as
a
it's
snack.
Not like a tapeworm or something.
I hope not. Yeah. I'm still fine. I haven't lost like 20 pounds. So
What is the most rugged place you've been to?
That was probably one of them. Wyoming, for sure. Just the mountain terrain you're climbing on horseback was intense. Yeah. You really had to trust. Okay. I had a mule, Johnny Walker. He was really cool. Very experienced. But the terrain they can climb and then descend, and it's rocky. So, you know, the horse and the mule slips.
Yeah,
but
going
they notice
down.
They stop and they collect themselves and then they study it in front of them and then they figure out their next step. I couldn't believe, I'm like, we're really climbing this or really going down this. And you just let the reins go and hang on. And they're fine. They do this all day long. It's wild to me. So that was really, really rugged. Another place my parents took us down, they'd always go to Mexico every single year from elementary school on, was kind of our spring trip. And my whole family loves the Latin culture, and we would take these adventure trips. And there was once my dad had a friend who had a small cottage on a beach in an undeveloped area. Hmm. And he had a family that took care of it, and the family lived on the property too, but it was like going back to, I don't know what era this was. Everything was cooked on a rock. We didn't have running water. You had to heat your water for a shower in a solar bag. It was like Gilligan's Island. And
that's so primitive.
Yeah, it was very primitive. There was no one around you for miles on the beach. But what it taught my sister and I at a young age is how much garbage comes in out of the ocean, from needles to everything else, because no one's raking up the beach every morning for you. And another, you know, she cooked fish, but it was like the full head and the eyeballs. It was cooked on a rock. And then she would, you know, the lovely family, but no one, she didn't speak any English. And my dad spoke maybe a little Spanish. And, you know, my sister and I at young ages now, you know, you get fish served like that in a restaurant. You're like, it's amazing. And it was good. But when we first looked at it, both of us were like, what? My dad was like, eat it.
So you and ate like, the don't eyeballs make faces. And everything.
No, but you know, you peel it back. But when you're young, I mean, we were like 10 and 12 or something. This is the first time we've ever seen a full head fish, you know, cook. Because they do salt it, do that in the restaurants. But back then we were, you know, like, what? And we had to shake our shoes out for scorpions at night. And so that was pretty rugged.
That's super rugged.
Yeah. And it was fun.
Do you prefer beach or mountain?
You know, I like variety. I just, I'm not one way or the other. That's the same thing with, you know, is it outdoors or is it fashion? I love experiencing as many different things as possible. When it's different for me, I like it.
Okay. Spring break is coming up. Let's say we're back to normal.
Okay.
You going to the mountains to go ski, or are you going to the beach to put your foot the
fitness in? I am, because I had my trip canceled for COVID. Going to Hawaii with my boyfriend, Dan, and I am going to do the island of Lanai.
Yeah.
I won a trip. I don't win anything, so I'm not a lucky person, but I won a trip to the Four Seasons in Lanai. I don't know how I got so lucky, but I did. And Lanai and this island of Maui, which are right next to each other, are they have a super high population of axis deer, and it's AXIS, and they are an invasive species. So they have a population problem.
I heard they're everywhere.
Yes, they're almost like
mice. So
you're
just going to go hunt?
And axis deer is some of the top venison meat you can eat in the world. And so I'm going to go hunt axis deer and just go on a day or maybe 2 day hunt. I might harvest a doe and then ship all the meat back. Because I guess doe meat can sometimes be a little bit better tasting just with the lack of testosterone in the meat. But anyway, I've heard axis deer is incredible.
Yes.
So I thought, you know what? I'm going to try this and then get to stay at the Four Seasons. I mean, could you have a better combination?
You're right. I posed what I thought was a trap question where you had to answer one of them, mountains or beach, and you're going to go do both.
Yeah, I mean, Hawaii, Hawaii has mountains, but hunting and then beach, that's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's
so
amazing.
And I had it all booked, but then I got canceled with COVID, so I'm going to make that happen probably this spring, if we can, if it's open again.
Well, you talk about the axis deer and the meat and all that stuff. With your cooking show, I don't know how experimental you guys get with all of the wild game, but what is your – how about we do this question? What's your least favorite wild game?
Goose, Canadian goose.
Yeah.
Tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people make it into brats or kind of blend it with a different meat or something. But another thing too is hunters don't leave the skin on, and it takes a lot of time to pluck a goose. Mm. And so you're working with goose breast meat, and it just doesn't have fat on it at all. And yeah, so that's probably my least favorite. But I did hear snow geese, because they, in the fall, they gorge themselves because they're so far up into Canada that they need all the extra fat to stay warm, that they are full of fat. And apparently they're amazing to eat. Mm. But I've not hunted snow geese before, but I guess they're supposed to be incredible. But yes, Canadian, or Canada goose, excuse me, would be for sure the least favorite.
Yeah, my father-in-law gave me some goose jerky, I think, one
time. Yeah, they
point
do that too, yeah.
And he loved it. I'm like, I mean, even in a jerky, I feel like you put anything in a jerky and I'll eat it.
Yeah.
But that to me was like, nope, that's a hard pass. That's just not even real appetizing.
And some people like it. It's just not for me either. You know what else? Sturgeon. I have tried sturgeon
twice. I've never had sturgeon.
I'd love to try to catch the sturgeon and release it. And I had it at a fancy restaurant and both times, and I'm like, this is an absolute no.
Yeah.
And someone said, yeah, you never want to eat a fish that's older than you. And I was like, that's a good point. Don't do it.
Yeah,
because they're like old.
Yeah.
They're like prehistoric old. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know, when they get that big, I think they are pretty old.
So then what's your favorite?
Favorite elk. Moose is excellent. Caribou's great. Elk, yeah, for sure elk and moose are the top two.
Just a plain steak?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The backstraps are, of course, are like the gold part of, which is like the tenderloin kind of.
Yeah.
Would be the best. You know, I like pheasant too, when it's cooked right. Walleye is obviously fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like a lot of it. Venison is challenging at times based on how the meat was harvested and then also what the deer ate. Because, you know, a lot of times if that stress hormone gets going for the animal, the cortisol can ruin the meat. And then, you know, up north, I think they're with pine needles and stuff like that. That changes the flavor profile versus down south. I think they are eating more corn and things. So that can be a difference too.
Well, which is fascinating because they say the same thing about cattle. About cows. You know, I watched this documentary on Temple Grandin, who is this animal rights activist. I think she's on the spectrum, and so nobody really took her seriously, but she, because of her mental capacity, she could sort of understand what the animals were going through.
Mm-hmm.
And she truly changed and revolutionized the way that we, sounds terrible, but slaughter cattle.
Absolutely.
And they found out that the process was so archaic and almost just like inhumane in the way they just like pushed them into these areas, and then you know, the way that they would kill them and stuff, and all of that stress of being around in big groups, being shoved in tiny pens and being led around, you know, around these dark corners and into this facility, you get the meat, and they'd harvest the meat, and it was tough.
Yep.
And they found out that it was truly the way that they treated them right before they killed them.
Very
and
true.
Slaughtered them. And so she sort of in her own way, I guess she would get on all fours. And she would act like an animal and say and feel like what the animal is going through. And so they changed like even how they sort of funnel them together and they mm-hmm. space them out and they make sure that every corner is kind of wide open so there's no hidden corners and stuff like that. And they said that it's now much more humane, and actually we as humans are benefiting from that because the meat's better.
Absolutely. I believe that.
Yeah. It's fascinating how just that process, you could do everything right as far as feeding them, taking care of them, and then that 30 minutes before they get slaughtered,
stress. Mm-hmm.
That cortisol can ruin the meat.
100%. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I for sure firm believer in that.
I have a couple questions here for you and, as we wrap this thing up. We've kind of covered some of these. Maybe this one you just answered. What's your favorite Minnesota destination?
Oh, boy, there's some good ones. Favorite Minnesota destination. You know, one destination that was really fun and super unique for Minnesota is in southern Minnesota, going towards Red Wing. There's a park there. It's called Mason State Park, I want to believe. And There's a big limestone wall, huge limestone wall, and there's this little creek that runs right next to it, and I don't know the name of the creek that's right next to it, but it used to be an area where Native Americans would put their camp because of the water and the wall to block the wind and in weather and things like that. And it's a state park, and a lot of people don't know this, that southern Minnesota used to be under the ocean at one point.
I didn't know that.
And you can go fossil hunting in the state park, and it's filled with fossils that are millions of years old from when the Minnesota was under the ocean. And I did a story for Minnesota Bound on fossil hunters, and they have a group, and there's this woman, she's called the Fossil Lady, and you can look her up if you Google her. I'm sure Fossil Lady Minnesota, she'll come up. And she is a total character, and she takes people out on fossil hunting, your kids would love this, tours. And her whole barn is filled with so many fossils from that are all millions of years old, and her whole garden is. And then right like a couple, 1 mile from her house is the state park. And she takes you in the little stream you can fossil hunt, and then just in the ditches. I found just from being there for a couple hours, like 5 or 6 fossils.
Wow.
Just within that short time. And there was a group that all collected. She had her group of fossil hunters, like hardcore fossil hunters. And this one woman she does fossil hunting for dinosaur poop.
Yeah, sounds appetizing.
And there's a technical term, which is now slipping my name. I'll have to look it up. Anyway, but she brought her sample of dinosaur poo to the group. And the one thing that is unique about dinosaur poo when you find it that's fossilized, which means it's a rock at this point, is that it sticks to your tongue.
What?
So, yes. It does. And it was like
this
little bit.
What do you mean it sticks to your tongue?
It sticks to your tongue. If you just stick it, touch it to your tongue, it stays there. Like a 3M stick-it note. Like post-it note.
Gross.
It's wild. That's what I said.
Who first discovered that?
I have no idea. And she was wearing this t-shirt with that had like a T-Rex on it. And it said like, holy crap. It was kind of funny. And she was a total character. And I said, you want me to taste it? She's like, well, you're not tasting it, which is right. You don't.
Yeah,
it's a rock.
Yeah,
but she's
rock.
Like, yeah, you're testing it. And she rubbed it down with alcohol, of course. And sure enough, I stuck it to my tongue and it stayed there. Like, it doesn't come off.
And did it actually have a taste?
No. It's
no.
a rock.
Yeah.
Total rock.
I don't know if it had like sort of a minerally taste.
No,
to it
I know.
Like, yeah.
And then she even showed me some other fossils that had water that was stuck in the fossil that was millions of years old. It still had water in it.
And that's all right down just by Red Wing.
Yeah, in Mason State Park.
Mason State Park. Okay.
I'm putting it on my list. So that's a really cool, kind of not really highly known part of Minnesota. Or
yes.
something about Minnesota.
Yeah. Okay. Why French Bulldogs?
Oh, I get this question all the time. It's a fun one. When I was looking for a dog, I live downtown. I'm soon to be moving. But I have been downtown in the North Loop, which I'd love forever because, again, it's close to the airport. Mm-hmm. I'm traveling all the time. And again, I get the city life and the country life all in the same time just by my work. So I wanted a dog that didn't have a lot of maintenance or a lot of exercise needs. I don't think it was fair to have kind of a high-energy hunting dog downtown just because I don't have the time to give it what it needs.
Sure.
So I decided upon the French Bulldog breed, and they don't bark. So I like dogs that are confident dogs. They're not hyper, and they're non-barkers. So it's hard to sometimes get the high-energy barking to have them calm down. Yeah, they don't bark. They'll bark if someone maybe comes to the door, but in general, they're quiet. So I purchased my first French Bulldog, and I brought him home, and my dad was like, what in the hell are you going to do with that? This is what he said. I was
sure.
What do you mean? Dad. And then as my dad got to know Bacon One, he fell in love with that breed. He loves the French Bulldog breed because they're very funny. They do really funny things, and they just are total clowns just in their nature. And so I then got a second one. And now, you know, my boyfriend and I, we travel. We actually live between Seattle and Minneapolis. So we go back and forth all the time. And I wanted a dog that I can take with me.
Yeah.
So it just kind of fit the bill. And I would love, you know, with all my heart to get a lab, and but it just was kind of where my life has gone. And
yeah.
So I just stuck with French Bulldog breed.
Well, again, you've found this little niche thing that works for you.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Exactly.
Okay, here's an interesting one. Do you have, when you get ready to do Minnesota Bound or any other show that you're doing, you're about ready, or maybe it's shoot day. Do you have a pre-shoot ritual? Do you have anything, quirky things that you do that you make sure either say to yourself or you the way you get ready that day?
I don't have any weird quirks per se. I do warm up my voice before I start shooting, just because with being female, it's really important that you keep your voice in what they call a lower register when you're speaking on television, because, you know, the higher your voice goes, it actually can become really annoying to those listening to it.
Mm.
So men don't have this issue because their voices are naturally lower. So as a female, you kind of have to work on that. So I do warm up my voice. Other than that, I listen to country music all the time when I'm on my way to a shoot. That kind of gets me into, if it's an outdoor
groove,
shoot, that gets
yeah.
me in the groove. I make sure if it's something where it's live TV that I go over everything, you know, that I'm really prepared the night before,
yeah.
but that's common. I think it's like super quirky. No.
Yeah, no.
All no.
Right. All right. What's your favorite gun?
Favorite gun? I love – well, I shoot Benelli's, mm-hmm. But I am thinking about purchasing a new shotgun. It's by a company called Siren, and they are really well-made shotguns for women, and they are already pre-fit. So when you buy a shotgun, Benelli per se, it is basically – many of them are fit for – men. They're longer in the stock and things
yep.
like that. So you have to go to a gunsmith and have them either shim down or fit for you. And that can be really tricky because it's an art to get it right.
Mm.
And so I've had some struggles with a couple of my Benellis that just weren't fit right. And so when the pattern's off, you know, if you become less accurate, and sometimes it has to do more with the gun even than it does with you. So the Siren gun is brand new on the market, and I shot it a couple times, and it's really, really, really nice because it's just pre-fit for you off the shelf, which is a gift. They're finally making shotguns for women, which is amazing. And there's some other manufacturers now that have them too, but that one I did really enjoy shooting. So it's on the list.
I see what you did there, though. You blamed it on the gun. You said, if I miss.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Why would I blame it?
I mean, no, it's not my eyesight. It's not me. Yeah. It couldn't possibly be me not leading the target.
Yeah, exactly.
Plaid or camo?
Can I do a combo? I will say camo.
Okay.
But like fashion camo.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah.
You can do any sort of
not
fashion.
Not Masio camo. Camo.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So your own spin on camo.
Yeah. Well, you know, so much camo's like seems to come back every single fall now.
Yeah.
So I like splashes of camo, like if it's a camo handbag or something, that's kind of fun. Pair of camo sneakers, that's fun.
Wintertime, earmuffs or stocking hat?
Stocking hat, always. I live in a hat in the winter, and even inside.
Even
inside?
I
love having a hat on.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just now getting to the point where I can wear it. Even in baseball, when I was a kid, I did not like wearing my hat. I don't know. There's something about it. Just like it didn't allow my head to breathe. And I'm a sweater. Like I just sweat all the time.
Yeah.
So it actually just made me feel hot. So I didn't. But now as I'm getting older and losing more hair, I'm like, okay, now it's kind of a utility thing.
Yeah.
I gotta cover.
Now it's necessary.
Yeah. Now it's necessary.
I feel like I love baseball caps, but I feel like it rubs on your forehead. I'm like, is it going to break my hair off?
It's kind of like, again, finding that pair of blue jeans or the jeans that just fit perfectly.
Yes.
I got to find the right hat because it's, you know, I don't know what it is with my ears because I don't really want like a big tall hat.
No.
And then there's other – I have one that I really like, but it kind of presses on my forehead in the front.
They're hard
there's like
to
a
get
weird
the right
seam.
Fit.
I know. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Favorite campfire food?
I like campfire food that's not fried. So if it's grilled on the campfire, I'm all in.
Gotcha.
I don't like fried foods.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about meat, but do you like organ meats? And if so, what is your favorite?
The answer is no to all of that. I know they're so good for you.
I know. They're
not
really
for
good.
Me. I'm not going to do it.
I know. I've tried eating liver and I can't do it.
No.
That's
a non-starter.
Yeah. Have you ever been in any real danger in the outdoors?
Well, you know, this summer, you know, not like I've never been in real danger when I've been way out in really wild places, because I think you're so prepared. And that's one thing I have learned. I actually attended, when I was doing some work for the Outdoor Channel, they sent us to the California School of Survival. And this is a hardcore, this is where they send a lot of military people to learn how to survive if you get stranded in the middle of nowhere, basically naked. Like, you have to do everything from scratch. And we were filming there, and they were adamant that this is not faked. Like, Laura is not going to get help building her fire. She will not get help building her shelter. Because, you know, a lot of times they have people to help you so you can get through a shoot faster, because it takes so long.
Yeah.
And we have 18 million other things to do that day. And they were like, no, this has to be. So we had to stay there all day, which is fine. And it was actually kind of cool. So I had to do everything as if I was in the school. And they're like, well, there's no faking it on this school. So we're like, okay. And you had to build a shelter. So you have to find all your twigs and sticks and figure out how you're going to build a shelter for night. Then you have to build a rock wall. So you learn that the heat will escape that way. So you build a rock wall behind the fire so it pushes the heat into your shelter, how to trap a rodent underneath the rock, how to manage, like, if you find a wrapper or if you have a granola bar wrapper, how to use that, the reflection on one side, to use it to maybe reflect something to see so someone sees you. If you have a string, it all comes down to, like, you make a stupid mistake with maybe a piece of string. And you're like, oh, I need this for helping me with, like, a fire or tie something. And you cut it in half. They're like, critical mistake, because you actually may down the road need the whole string. Like, things like that where your mind will start playing games with you. And, like, what rodents to eat, what rodents not to eat, how to boil water in a plastic bag so you can sterilize it to drink it.
A plastic bag? Mm-hmm. You can do that?
Yes. Yeah, so you dig a hole in the sand and you put a plastic bag in it. And then you put the water from, like, the river, the stream, in that. And you take rocks and you throw rocks in the fire until they get to, like, 600 degrees. And then you take the rocks and drop them without touching the plastic into the water. And it boils the water to kill any of the parasites.
Oh.
I know. This school is crazy. And the guy teaching this school, I swear, has been out in the woods for so long. He was fascinating. Like, I don't think he's even seen a woman in, like, I don't know how many years. I was like, it was so wild working with him. He was like a different character because he has been in the woods for so long. He teaches. He's the one who teaches military, Navy SEALs. They all go out there for his school. It's crazy.
Lucky you. That's
it was
super fun.
I'm glad it was just one day because it was so intense. I was like, I'm exhausted.
But, you know, that's a great segue into my very last question. And I actually had that written down in my notes. And then you sort of touched on it already. If you were on Naked and Afraid, what would be your one tool that you get to bring?
Matches. Fire. 100% waterproof matches.
Yeah. Not the little fire starter.
No, waterproof matches. Do not ever leave home without those. If you've ever attempted to start a fire with a stick and some...
Never tried.
And if you are under the adrenaline rush of, I have to stay out here all night, I'm going to freeze to death, I guarantee you, you're probably not going to be able to do it. It's really hard to do it with an instructor there, and you're calm and you're relaxed and you're just doing this for practice. Whew. No, he's like, waterproof matches, 100%. Even if it's waterproof matches and then that piece of, it's like tinfoil, but it's not tinfoil. It's just as a body wrapper to keep your body heat.
Yeah.
Also very important. I would say those two things. You can always, like, find ways. Mm-hmm. You even have those pills or something to filter your water, but water and fire,
that's it.
Body heat.
Yeah.
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 If you have fire, you can do a lot of things with fire.
All right. Duly noted.
Yeah.
I can't.
Small. You can put those in your pocket.
That's true. That's true. I can't thank you enough. You are a super fascinating person.
Aww,
and I think,
thank you for
and
me.
I hope that everybody listening can understand just and be inspired, I think, by everything that you're doing. And how you've sort of carved out this niche, not because you felt like there was a void in one area. It's just like you're doing you. You know, you're doing what you love to do. And I think that's the big takeaway, is that you're just having fun doing what you want to do. You know, you got inspired by your dad about the outdoors, which is amazing. We're all inspired by our parents and our upbringing, our backgrounds. But you've always loved fashion, and then you go to University of Wisconsin and you get your degree, and then you go do that whole world for many years, and then you kind of put them together because you're like, I like both. Why can't I do both? You know? And you're breaking barriers, which I think is amazing.
Thank you. No, it's been a really fun ride. And, you know, back in the day when I was in LA and I had many agents, when I was trying to get an agent, say you have to be one person or the other. You can't be both those people because it doesn't make sense. And I just was so confused, and I was like, well, but that's who I am. So, and why can't you? And why would you ever put limits on people? Because I don't think anybody should ever be put in a certain box to say you have to be this or this, because people really are limitless and they're multidimensional. So be that.
Yeah.
Don't ever limit yourself because, oh, I grew up in a small town, so I can't ever, you know, how would I ever be a city person and a small town person or whatever it is? Just don't put limits on yourself.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
I love it. All right. You heard it here, guys and gals. Be you, and people will love you for being you. So thank
Absolutely.
You very much.
Oh, thanks for having me. Super fun.
All right. See ya. So that will do it with Laura Shera here on Unrestricted. She's a delightful woman. She's doing 1,000 different things in and around the Twin Cities in Minnesota. So please give her all your support. Give her a follow on all of your social media channels. Look her up and support everything that she's doing. I want to thank Dave Yeager for helping me out with this podcast. Appreciate you, Dave. And I want to thank you guys as the listeners for supporting this podcast. And as always, please like the podcast, give us some feedback, just be gentle, and subscribe to our podcast on either Spotify, Apple, Google, or iHeartMedia Podcast. So thank you all. We'll see you next week. Bye. So that will do it with Laura Shera here on Unrestricted. She's a delightful woman. She's doing 1,000 different things in and around the Twin Cities in Minnesota. So please give her all your support. Give her a follow on all of your social media channels. And look her up and support everything that she's doing. I want to thank Dave Yeager for helping me out with this podcast. Appreciate you, Dave. And I want to thank you guys as the listeners for supporting this podcast. And as always, please like the podcast, give us some feedback, just be gentle, and subscribe to our podcast on either Spotify, Apple, Google, or iHeartMedia Podcast. So thank you all. We'll see you next week. Bye.